Join with me as we read John chapter 2, starting in verse 13. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and money changers sitting there. And making a whip out of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So the Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking about the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. You may have your seats. So tonight's title is Cleaning House, because one of the commentators I looked at actually called it this. He called cleaning house. Jesus came in and cleaned out his house a little bit that night. As I was kind of unpacking this, it made me kind of wonder, like, what makes me angry? I don't know why that question came to my mind, because Jesus seemed like he was a little ticked off. And I was like, what makes me angry? What makes Dave angry? You know, what makes me, you know, steam off a little bit, like this guy, you know, get a little like, oh, what makes me angry to the point of, not to the point of sin, but to the point of maybe a little righteous anger. And I thought, well, first of all, I need to think about what makes my wife angry, because every good husband needs to do that, right? So what makes my wife angry is a cluttered house, okay? So, I mean, that's you know, can get cluttered like that. That makes Darcy a little bit angry, is a cluttered house. What makes her even more angry is when I say words like this: "Honey, our house isn't cluttered. Everything is just on display like a museum." Okay, so insert foot here for things like that if I say them. Then I thought, what really makes me angry? And my wife is in service tonight. Sometimes my mother-in-law, bless her heart, she makes me a little bit angry, okay? This is not a picture of my mother-in-law, but I wouldn't dare put one up because she might actually watch this on the internet. And so I'm not going to do that. But sometimes my mother-in-law, you know, could make me a little bit angry. But then I looked up, and Google's awesome because everything on Google is true. So I found these 10 things that make people angry on Google. And here's what Google said, 10 things that make people angry. Number one, bad drivers, right? I just moved up here from San Francisco, from the Bay Area. Driving here is so easy, you guys. Oh, man, Calusa, it took me 15 minutes to go from here to there. I'm like, really? 15 minutes? Okay, try to drive the Bay Bridge at 5 o'clock on a Thursday and tell me 15 minutes. Okay, robocalls. Anybody tired of robocalls? Like, my phone is just now blown up. I got a robotext right here, right now. Like, who's texting me? It's a robotext. People who talk too loud on the phone. Have you guys ever done that? Like, "Hey, Joe, what's happening? How you doing? Good to see you. Yeah, well, we'll see each other golfing tomorrow, but man, I thought I'd call you." What really annoys me is when people do that at the golf course. "Hold on, I've got to take this call." "Yeah, bro, no, it's a $3 million deal, okay? I'm telling you what, it's good. It's all good." Oh, my goodness. People who let their kids scream in public places. I mean, if you do that, no offense, but it bothers me. And it bothers a lot of other people on Google. Obviously, right? Like, you're going to let your kids just scream? Like, scream it out. We're in Nordstrom. Just scream it out. You know, like, I can't even hear the piano player. I don't know. Sitting in gum. Okay, there's one of you that may sit in gum tonight. I'm just saying, don't be mad at the church. Just be mad that somebody left their gum on your seat, okay? But that would irritate me as well. It would irritate me more if I got gum in my hair, okay? Just saying. Or actually, if our guitar player got gum in his hair, that would be the worst. Okay. Not being able to get Wi-Fi. That's a thing now, right? People get mad because they can't get Wi-Fi. And I know some of you are in here like, "I don't know the church's Wi-Fi password." Please don't get on it. We have only limited bandwidth, okay? We're trying to fix that. But delays at the airport. Anybody get frustrated with delays at the airport? I don't know. What's the over-under? 3 hours on an airplane? I mean, there's now a law that says you can't sit on. I remember one time I sat over 3 hours on an airplane in Omaha, Nebraska, okay? What do you do on an airplane in Omaha, Nebraska for 3 hours? You sit there and wait is what you do. Running out of toilet paper. I actually wrote a parody song. I thought about playing it tonight, but I won't. You can go on my YouTube channel, DavidSauer530, and see that, okay? And it's called "I Will Never, Ever, Ever Run Out of Toilet Paper." I'm in a house of five daughters and a wife. We run out of toilet paper, it's like World War III breaks out. I'm just saying. It's awful. Going to the DMV, we can all agree with that one. We can all agree with that one. But the number one thing that makes people mad on Google, The Kardashians. Okay, I don't know. I didn't make it up. It's Google. That's Google, okay? It's the Kardashians. That's the number one thing that makes people mad on Google. But my question is, what makes us mad? What makes us angry? What makes you guys angry? And I have an arrow pointing to the left and the right because I'm not sure which side your spouse is sitting on, but typically it's the person sitting next to you that makes you the most angry. So turn to them right now. I know Jeff did this earlier, but turn to them right now and give them your angry face, okay? Turn to the person next to you. If you don't have anybody next to you, turn behind you, find somebody to give your angry face to. Okay, that was my best angry face. That was my very best angry face. So I want to get into the text a little bit with you and understand this. When Jesus, last week we learned about Jesus and his very first miracle turning water into wine. Now, many of the commentators I read would say this was actually his second miracle, clearing out the temple courts. And here's why. It was pretty fascinating because in those days, Passover was a big deal, but because people had to walk so far, the Jews actually changed the law and said, not everybody has to come to Passover. You only have to come if you live within a day's walk. But people would get their lifelong desire and passion to make the journey from long and far to go to the temple in Jerusalem to celebrate Passover with their brothers and sisters. They would come from far and wide to go there, but sometimes it was only a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for them. And it was kind of crazy because scholars will say that there were anywhere between 1 million and 2.5 million people in a town of 200,000. You got to remember, Jerusalem wasn't that big. It was about 200,000 people, and there were up to 2.5 million people that would come down on the town. So part of the reason the Jews made the law is just so many people were coming. They said, we just don't want this many people. But in Jesus' time, there were still probably 1 million people the day Jesus went to the temple. Imagine 1 million people in a town of 200,000. That'd be like the Sikh parade hitting downtown Yuba City with 1 million people. Okay, that'd be like Sacramento Kings winning the NBA championship. Okay, there'd be a flood of 1 million people in downtown Sacramento. Miracles do happen. Okay, that might be Jesus' 30th miracle. But see, here's the thing. Jesus shows up, and this was a big, big deal to a lot of people. And I had to think, what made Jesus so angry? What makes Jesus angry? I had to think about that because I go, okay, what makes Dave angry? What makes all of you angry? But what makes Jesus angry? And as I'm thinking about that and I'm trying to process this, I had to go to Scripture to look at what makes Jesus angry. And I found in Proverbs 6, it says basically these seven things. It says there are six things that the Lord hates. And there are seven things he despises. And these are the seven things. Number one is arrogance. He does not like haughty eyes, is what the Bible calls that. Haughty eyes. Which doesn't mean like, hey, what's up, baby? That's not what they mean by that. It means you think you're better than other people. He doesn't like lying. Well, we all kind of know what that one is, right? He doesn't like lying lips. Oppression. He doesn't like us to oppress other people, his people. Wickedness. The word says he doesn't like us running after evil things. Wickedness and chasing. He doesn't like us to do that. Now, so many of us, we dabble in evil things. Well, God doesn't like that when we do that. He doesn't like us. I don't think God likes us watching horror movies. I'll be quite honest, as one of your pastors, I don't think it's wise for us as Christians to expose ourselves to the evil of a horror movie, especially a demonic-based kind of horror movie. Okay, some of us like see, oh, Friday the 13th, I remember that when I was 12. And you stop on it, you're like, gosh, this is the cheesiest movie ever, right? We think that now. But what about some of these movies that are out today and some of them that we let our kids watch? And they like to watch them because they like to be scared. Cheating. Now, the Bible doesn't say cheating on one's spouse or cheating on a math test or cheating at your driving exam, which I don't know how you could do. I tried once. It actually means cheating others out of what they rightly have or deserve. And then number seven is provoking, poking, antagonizing. Stirring things up. Are we stirring things up with others? How do we do that as Christians sometimes? Gossip. That's how we do that. So here's Jesus. He lands in the temple and he sees what's going on. He's like, I think I'm a little angry. See, he sees them not having reverence. I think that's the obvious one that all of us just rightly go to, right? They're not being reverent in God's house. They're not being reverent. We go there right away. So there was a lack of respect in God's house. But I think it's a little bit more than that. See, I want to point out the verse. So when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem in the temple courts and he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. Now, you ask yourself, well, gosh, we sold movie tickets the last few weeks here at Adventure. You know, there's other things we've sold, maybe shirts or we've sold, you know, we maybe sell these cups. People are going to be, I want one of those cups. You want one of those cups, you pay one of us $5, okay? Those cups cost us $5. But Jesus is going, here's the thing. For centuries, people were selling stuff at the temple courts. Why? Well, because you journey for 3, 4, 5 days with your best piece of livestock, your best sheep, your best cow, your best chicken, your best whatever, and you travel that far with it that long, you risk that livestock being damaged. And you don't want to present God anything but your best. And so they would come to the temple courts, they would buy a livestock, and yeah, the people selling it, they'd make a little bit of money. But then over time, the priest would figure out they could make a little bit more money. So instead of selling a cow that cost, you know, that might have cost them $10 and they sell it for $12 and make a little bit for their service fee and the square charges them $2 or one of those kind of things, right? That's not the case. That cow that costs them $10, they're going to charge them $100. Or when the person comes in that doesn't have anything, that has little or nothing, and all they want to do is take a dove, take a little pigeon, and they want to present that to God, and they have their last bit of money, their last $5, and that dove on the street would maybe cost them a nickel, and they go in there and they get taken advantage of, and they have to pay their only $5 they have to buy that dove, to present it to God, because it means everything to them to present it to Him. So they're willing to take every last dime out of their pocket and lay it on the table to buy a nickel dove. See, Jesus looked at that and he's like, there's no respect here. There's no respect. There's no reverence. They're taking advantage of my people, the people I came to save. See, Jesus said he came to seek and save those who were lost. And all these people, that all they wanted to do was worship their God. All they wanted to do was worship our God, and they get ripped off trying to do it. They get ripped off trying to do it. Hebrews 12, verse 28 says, Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence. And I wrote the word respect below reverence and awe. In those days, reverence and respect was they brought their best to the temple to be sacrificed. They brought their best to the temple to be sacrificed. That was their reverence. They didn't have an awesome worship band with cool drums and a stinking rock star. I mean, who is this guy? I'm like, can I have your autograph? I'm like starstruck. I'm like, I'm taking a picture of him. I'm trying to get a selfie with him. Sitting in the front row. It's like amazing. They didn't have that. They maybe had some guy singing really badly, but they knew that the God, the creator of the universe, would receive their gift. And that's all they wanted to do was please Him. Please Him. So their lack of respect was in God's house. The purpose of God's house was corrupted. The purpose of God's house was corrupted and being corrupted. It says in verse 16, to those who sold doves, he said, get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market. His disciples remembered that it is written, zeal for your house will consume me. Now when you look up that Psalm 69 verse, it's really interesting what it really means. It means our excitement, our enthusiasm, our motivation to come in here and worship God. We should be looking at our watches at 5:30 going, honey, let's go to church. Come on, let's get there early so we can get a good seat and sit in the front. Sit all you back row Baptists back there, okay? I mean, it's empty up here. I'm like, there's nobody in the front row. I mean, not a single person. I was sitting there. What, do I smell? Nope, I put on deodorant. I'm just saying. Oh, and here comes the guy walking up. Okay, good, he didn't come to the front row. But you know, here's the thing. That zeal is important. We should walk in here, and this should be the most awesome place that we want to step foot in every single week. The cruddiest week we've had at work, I almost said crappy, by the way, but this is church, so I probably shouldn't say that. The cruddiest day we've had at work, the cruddiest week, and we come here, and our spirits should be lifted. This should be a place we should be pumped up to be at. You should go over there and see kids' church right now, man. I heard the music playing when they opened the door, and I was like, praise the Lord. Those kids are pumped to be here. They're excited to be here. They can't wait to come to church. I know when I was a kid, I couldn't wait to not go to church. But they turned his house into a market. They turned his house into a marketplace. In other words, there was, you know, cattle and sheep everywhere and birds, and it was a farm. It was a barnyard. And here's the thing. Where all the animals were, where they were located in the temple courts, and I almost put a picture of it up, but I was like, it's too grainy. I couldn't make it work, so I didn't. And we have too good of projectors now. I have to do cool slides so you guys get, wow, those are good, right? Well, because the projectors are good. But here's the thing. The outskirts of the temple court was for the Gentiles that had converted to Judaism. And that's where all this was taking place. It was the new believer not being welcomed into the church. It was like the new believer that found the greatest gift ever. The God of the universe loved them, and they could love the God of the universe back, and they could honor him and respect him in reverence. And people said, no, you're not welcome, because you got to get through all this to get to the God of the universe. And in fact, the way you get through it is we're going to rip you off. And not only did they rip them off, they made it a marketplace. They also made it a place where they collected a tax. So imagine here at Adventures, the ushers come forward. And ushers, my cue here, ushers, you coming forward again? Okay. And we say, okay, now that you pay tithes and offerings, will you also have to pay us another 5% on top of that before you leave tonight, or you're not welcome back next week? That's what they were doing to the people that were coming. And the other crazy thing is the people were coming, and they would come from far away, and it'd be their only journey ever to Jerusalem, their only journey ever. And they'd get there, and they'd have money from their land. And they said, oh, we're sorry, we don't take Canadian here. Okay, I grew up in Washington State. I remember the first time I went to Canada. It was the best trip ever, right? I was a Cub Scout. We go up to Kimberley, British Columbia. It looks like the Alps from Switzerland. It was just amazing, beautiful snow everywhere. And we get up there, we go to the store, and all I had is American money on me. My dad had given me $20. I was like, yeah. So I go up there and I go to the candy store, because whatever, 12 years old, you go to the candy store, right? So I go to the candy store and I buy like $2 worth of candy, and I put down 20 bucks and I get $21 back in change, all Canadian. I'm like, this is the greatest country ever. The exchange rate, right? I didn't know what it was. I'm just a kid, but I'm telling you what, when these people go in there with their Canadian money, it wasn't a $1.50 kind of rate. It was like $5. Oh, you brought a dollar, or you want a dollar? It's going to cost you $5. They were getting ripped off over and over and over again. It was all about corruption. It was all about making money. It was all about lining the pockets of the priests. Why do you think they could give Judas so much money to kill Jesus? Because they had it to blow. It was nothing to them. I like the Matthew account that happens later in this. And by the way, I'm going to pause here just for a second, because Brant and I went back and forth a little bit this week on this, trying to read about this, because a lot of people, including my wife, was, well, this story's only one time. It just lists it in the Gospels and, you know, in John and stuff, and listen to the other. And like, well, according to a bunch of these Bible scholars and according to these other scholars, this story actually, there's two accounts. There's one at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and he probably only had 5 disciples with him, which is the one we're talking about tonight. And then there's the one at the end of his ministry, just before he was hung on the cross, and he had all of his disciples. Well, so you can wrestle with that, because I'm still kind of wrestling with that. We'll find out in heaven, right? Because some people say John misplaced where he put it, and others. So that's one of the questions I'm going to ask Jesus. It goes to my list, okay? Jesus, tell me about the book of John. I just need to know where that story fit. Did you do it twice? Did you do it once? What? I don't know. But that being said, In the Matthew account of this, it says this, "It is written," he said to them, "my house will be called a house of prayer." Other versions call it a house of worship. But you are making it a den of robbers. Isn't that interesting that Jesus used the word den? I found that very interesting. He didn't use the word, you're making it a place for people to get stolen. Or he says a den, a place where people gather and they collaborate and they make a plan and then they execute the plan. In this case, people gathered together, they made a plan to rip people off, and then they went out when the people got there and they executed the plan and they ripped people off. They took advantage of them. The people in God's house were being mistreated. They were being mistreated. Now, here's one of the things I love about this text. If you read the next couple verses, is Jesus did this. He went out of the temple and he was still in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, and many people saw signs that he was performing and believed in his name. Now the people are going, "I'm going to go where they're at and I'm going to do miracles. I'm going to talk about what I do." And many people believed in Jesus. See, he knew what was coming. He's like, "Well, let's get it started. Let's get it started." Proverbs 29:2 says, "When the righteous increase, the people rejoice. But when the wicked rule, the people groan." When the wicked rule, people groan. See, I pictured in my mind that they weren't selling the best cattle in the marketplace. They were selling stuff like this. They weren't selling the best pigeons. They weren't selling the best sheep. They weren't doing the best exchange rate. They were ripping people off at every single level, at every step of the way. People were being taken advantage of and they were being misled. See, the leaders of God's house were misleading God's people. The leaders of God's house were misleading God's people. And here's how we know. Because when all this came down, they went to Jesus and said, "Prove it. Prove your authority. Prove it to us." Don't defensive people do stuff like that? Isn't that the posture of somebody being very defensive that knows they're wrong? Right? "Well, prove to me that I'm wrong. Prove it. Prove it. Can you prove it?" And what does Jesus do? Jesus could have, he could have had an adventure endgame moment right there and just snapped his finger, the infinity stones, and everybody, he could have done it then. No. He just said, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. I will raise it up in 3 days. In 3 days, I will raise it up." I remember having a conversation with my mother who's coming on Monday, and she's coming to town for about 10 days, and I'm excited to have her here, and it's always great to have mom in town, right? And you got to find a place for her to sleep, and you got to find and then mom always wants to be mom when she's here, and I'm like, "Mom, I'm like 51, bro, come on, seriously." But she's mom, so it all happens, and it's exciting. But I remember one time having a conversation about my mom and some of the televangelists that she wanted to support. And when my mom tells me she wants to support them, that told me she probably was. Now, I'm not trying to be offensive to anybody if you watch televangelists, and there are some really good guys. But I thought, every one of the people on the screen there had some time in their lives been accused of some kind of corruption, of some kind of misleading people that were giving them money. This isn't the sermon for it, but I hope Pastor Greg will do one as we walk through the text, is the storehouse that we give to should be our own first. I'm not telling you to not give to anybody on this screen, but I look at some of the televangelists, and I would highly recommend to do some vetting before you do some giving. See, I know at Adventure, you want to see the books? We'll open the books. You want to see what we're doing? Here you go. We have nothing to hide. But some of those people, they had a lot to hide. Now, I ask this question, it's a little bit rhetorical, but are we serious about seeking and worshiping Jesus at this church? And I think the answer is unequivocally yes. You know, when I was looking at taking this job, one of the things that I asked about with Pastor Greg, and Greg and I have been friends for a long, long time, but I asked him, I said, how are people's, and I didn't use the word zeal, but I'll use it tonight because it was in the text, how's people's zeal for the church? And he goes, "Dave, we have people that love to come to church. They want to worship. They're seeking more. They're seeking God every day in their lives." And I actually thought about ending early tonight and just going close it out right here, because you guys don't need to hear the rest of this message. Because you're already doing it. You're already making it happen. And I took this job, and that was the big reason why, because I didn't want to go to a dead church. I didn't want to go to a church that wasn't on fire for Jesus. that wasn't ready to change a community. I didn't want to go to a church that was, you know, I didn't want to go to a church that was sitting on their hands, just wanting to hear a good preacher and then leave and then go home and, okay. And then work your week and then come back next week. And Greg goes, I promise you, this church isn't like that. This church is serious about seeking and worshiping Jesus. And we all know what that means, right? We all know what that means, that we're doers. I love John 4, and I told Jeff I was going to share this tonight because this is a worship leader verse, and sometimes you got to be careful with the worship leaders. You don't want to step on their toes. So Jeff and I were talking. I said, I'm sharing the John 4 one, Jeff. Is that cool? He's like, yeah, that's good. But yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in the spirit and in truth. Amen. Right? Don't we want this place to be packed out with people? You know what I love to see? I love to see when people come to know the Lord, they're not cool. They're not like, you guys remember a couple of, like 6 months ago, I spoke and I showed a little Tim Hawkins video of worship, all the worship things. You guys remember that? You know, and they start out with people are new. They just like, what's up, Jesus? Woo! And they're just crazy. And you're like, they must be new. Whoa, that's a little uncomfortable. Or they came from GT, one of the two. I'm not sure, but some of you got that. Oh, most of it. Sorry. I won't say that tomorrow. I'll take that off my notes. But my question is, are we truly living for him beyond the walls of God's house? Because for people to come, they've got to see us doing it out there. You know, statistically, 80% of the people would come to church if they just had a personal invitation and you promised you'd be waiting outside for them. People want a personal invitation. And what's even better is when you pull up to their house and then they come out of their house and then they either get in the backseat of your car or they follow you. But you got to make sure if it's dark outside to keep their headlights close, okay? I'm just, because they may turn off and go to Chili's or something. But Gandhi said this. Gandhi said, if Christians would really live according to the teachings of Christ as found in the Bible, all of India would be Christian today. I would ask us that same question. If Christians in Yuba and Sunder County would really live according to the teachings of Christ as found in the Bible, would all of Yuba Sutter be Christians today? Would this region just be totally revived for Jesus today? I think the answer is yes. I think when you have 800 people living for Jesus, it changes the landscape of a community. Because 800 goes to 1,600, and 1,600 goes to 3,200, and 3,200 goes to 6,400, and we have campuses all over this region, and in the name of Jesus, we're making a difference. And we are being the church to a community that needs the church. So I have three homes that I have to take care of in my life. I think we all have three homes we have to take care of. What are those three homes? Like, some of you are like, we pay that guy way too much if he has three homes. Believe me, if you've been to my house, you know, okay, I have one home, and it was really bad for a while. It's getting better, though. It's almost done. We have three homes to take care of. Our number one home is our church home, Adventure. Or if you're visiting here from another church, you can write your church in there. We go to Adventure Saturday nights, but we're really part of blah, 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 blah church. And I have people that say that, oh, I don't really go here. I just come here on Saturday night because the worship and Pastor Greg are so good. And then they say it really fast because they don't want me to know, you know, like, I'm not going to call your pastor, okay, unless you ask me to. I won't call him until on you. But our church home is Adventure. And I shared this with our leadership team this week. Here are the four components that we have to make sure that we're taking care of at Adventure for all the other ministries to flow and work well. These are those four things. And number one is the weekend services. We have to make sure our weekend services are top-notch. We have to make sure that we're honoring God by giving God our best, and that is our best musicians, our best attempt at making slides, our best kids program on the weekends, our best preaching. We have to make sure this is off the chain good. Our children's ministry. We want our children's ministry to, we want our kids to want to come to church. We don't want them to be like me growing up as a kid when I had a drug problem. I got drugged to church on Sundays and Wednesdays. I mean, it was like all the time I was going to church. I didn't want to go to church. But we have kids over there, they can't wait to come to church. And if your kids are sitting in here, get them over there. It's fun. And if they want to be in here and listen to me, that's cool too, because it's like, I like kids. I have five. Our youth ministry. Do you understand, and I've said this in announcements before, but you understand that most people today accept Jesus between the age of 12 and 17 years old. It's like 76% of the people that say yes to Jesus do it between 12 and 17. So if we have a junk youth ministry, we're going to have junk kids. We got to have a great youth ministry. And guess what? Pastor Dallas is killing it. He's part-time and killing it. If you're a youth in here, we have a Saturday night thing over in our garage back here. You go to that. We just did a bowling thing. I lost to a teenager at bowling. I'm just saying. I admit my losses. His name was Ethan. He beat me by one, okay? By one. He's over there tonight. He's waiting for me to come over and play basketball. I said, yeah, no, I'm not playing. Growth groups, we just launched them. Guess what? When we got here, we had five. And then I'm like, let's ramp it up. Okay, let's get this going. Pastor Greg, Pastor Jordan, Pastor Brent, who can we call? What do we do? And we had 20 to launch with. And we're hoping that next round in the fall when we launch again big, that we have 40. That we have 40. We need 40. And if our growth group ministry is good, here's what happens when you have a really solid growth group ministry. Ministries like your meal train ministry changes. It doesn't necessarily go away, but it changes. How does it change? Because when the meal train happens, when somebody's in need of a meal, the first call comes into the office, because it always does, right? And when Christian answers the phone, hello, Adventure Church, Yuba City, how may I direct your call? Hey, we just ended up in the hospital. Is there any way we could help? What growth group are you in? Oh, I'm in so-and-so's. Great, let me call them for you and let them know what's going on and have your growth group take care of you. And then it's all driven through the growth groups, and then it becomes really, really healthy because a stranger, well, I'm not a stranger to some of you, but a stranger coming over to your house with a meal versus somebody that you do life with, what a difference. What a difference. That's why our growth group ministry needs to be stellar. So that's number one, our church home adventure. Number two is our own home. Put your last name there. Our own home. How's your marriage doing? How are things with your spouse? Is your date night church? Maybe you should go to Chili's after church. I mean, they do have a good, two for 25 deal or something going on right now. But your spouse, how is that going? How are your kids doing? How are they really doing? Do you sit down and have conversations with them? Do you sit down and actually talk to your kids about what's going on in their school? What girl or boy they like? Because sometimes those kind of questions can create conversations that you need to have with your teenager. Have you just gone on a drive with them and maybe to see how they drive, right? How are your household finances doing? If you only knew Pastor Dave. Well, I do. That's why we have a Dave Ramsey thing going on almost all the time. Maybe that's one of your challenges, is you're so upside down in debt that you need to learn some systems and processes of how to get that under control and get out of it. And we have people in the church that can help coach you in that. Literally, that will sit down and help you work out a budget and teach you how to get out of debt. And all of a sudden, your life gets turned back right side up because your finances get straightened out. And how's your future doing? Well, sometimes 3 and 4 are tied together quite a bit. But maybe your future, you've dreamt about going back to school and finishing an education or continuing an education so you get an advancement in your career. And maybe you need to go after that. How's that part of your home doing? Or maybe you're at the end of your home life and you're gonna go home to be with Jesus sometime in the next 20 years. Let's be real, that can happen at any time to any of us. But how does that future look? So that kind of leads me to my third home. And that's our personal home, me, myself, and I. How are you doing? You know, I remember a guy sitting in my office and his wife left him and his parents had passed away and he really had no one. They didn't have any kids. He's telling me everything that's going on in his life. And I said, stop for a minute. How are you doing? And he just broke out into tears. And how he was doing, he needed a really, really, really good cry. But he needed to get number one right. He needed to get his spiritual health dialed in. How's your spiritual health doing? How are you doing with your walk with Jesus? How are you doing with your Bible study? How are you doing with your small group? How are you doing with serving in the community or at the church or wherever? How are you doing with your spiritual journey? Are you praying every day? Or is your prayer right when you drive into work and you go, oh Lord, please let this be a good day at work. Amen. How's that journey? How's your physical health? Start looking at the kid part. We start looking at how are you doing physically? maybe you started these New Year's resolutions, and what are we, February 21st, and they're already over. You haven't, you know, you bought that weight set, you got the gym membership, you know, at least the weight set is, it can be a clothes hanger, okay? But where's your physical health at? Maybe you've been, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to, you know, work out, I'm going to look like, I told somebody the other day, I said, wait till next year, I'm going to look like The Rock. And then I looked in the mirror, I'm like, no way. Okay. How's your emotional health? You know, sometimes we just need to get some counseling. Sometimes we just need to go get some emotional adjustments made. I think it's interesting that we go take our car in every 3,000 miles to get the oil changed, but we won't go talk to somebody about our problems and talk to somebody about helping us emotionally. I think even as Christians, we're a little afraid to talk about those things. How's our emotional health doing? Maybe you had, like this guy, had a bunch of things happen in your life that were tragic, and you just need to talk to somebody. A pastor, a counselor, a therapist, the dog down at the dog park. I don't know. But maybe you just need to talk to somebody about that. But how's your relational health doing? Isn't it interesting how these things can be tied together so much? You know, we have these relationships that God puts in our lives. We don't work on them at all. What do we do with these relationships? We just kind of let them fester. We let them linger. We let them just kind of be what they are. We don't try to build on them. You know, well, my marriage is as good as it's going to get. I don't say this to pat myself on the back, but you know, when I say I've been married for 30 years and it's felt like a honeymoon for 30 years, I genuinely mean that. I work on my marriage every single day. Some days we fight to work on it, and other days we don't fight to work on it, but I work on our marriage every single day, and because that relationship is a ministry that God has placed in my life first. But how are all those relationships around you? Are they healthy, or do they need some work? Do they need some help? I almost did this as an illustration as we left, but I was going to put two tables up here, and it was going to be one of those come to the cross moments where you wrote down what you need God to clean out of your house and put it on the tables, but I thought, that's too much work. My computer crashed this week, and oh. But as you're thinking about it, what is it that Jesus needs to clean up in your house? What is it that he needs to clean up in the me, myself, and I house, or the house at home? We have a leadership team that knows what we need to clean up at Adventure. And we talk about that stuff all the time, and it's awesome to have a team that can talk about that. And that's cool. Your church is in good hands. It really is. I'm blown away by our leadership team. And I said the other night at the leadership team meeting, I said, we have the greatest pastor. We have the greatest pastor in this whole area. And we need to lift him up in prayer, because all the enemy wants to do is take him out. Pastor Greg loves each and every one of you with every ounce of his being. Part of why he brought me on board is that I could be a little bit of the mean guy once in a while, because he just can't. And that's good. He's not just my friend, but he is my pastor too. But think about what you have in your life that needs to be cleaned out by Jesus. What is that?